Good morning. And would you open your Bibles with me, please, to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 20, Matthew 20, Kingdom Values. There's an insert for keeping notes if you desire. Most of us, if not all of us, love a good story. And Jesus is going to tell us a story today. What will it reveal to us of God's heart? What will it reveal to us of our own heart? If we are following with the sort of the patterns that we've been reading over the past 2 weeks and into this week, we're going to see that we are being called to reflect upon our attitudes, our hearts, and our actions towards others and towards God's kingdom. And we're being drawn to consider how to be more like Jesus and have his attitude towards the kingdom. How can this happen? And what does it look like? So as we go through here, I'd like to engage us on 3 points. I want to, after reading this story, this parable, want to ask us what a parable is. Because if I want to do a couple of things throughout the tenure I have here at Westminster, is not only teach the Bible, but teach you how to read it with greater profit. So what is a parable? Secondly, is what does this parable say? It's fairly straightforward, I think. But the third part is, what does this parable mean? And it's hardly straightforward when we come to that, I would suggest. But let's go to chapter 20. In fact, let's draw in the last verse of the preceding chapter, chapter 19 and verse 30, because that's probably where we should start. And it reads as follows in 19, verse 30. Many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About the third hour, that's about 9 o'clock in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. He went out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same thing about the 11th hour. He went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one's hired us," they answered. He said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." When the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." The workers who were hired about the 11th hour, so they'd work maybe 1 hour, hired from 5 o'clock to 6 in the afternoon, hired in the 11th hour came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they'd worked 12 hours, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. "These men who were hired last worked out only 1 hour," they said, "and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, "Friend, I am not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. And this is the word of our Lord. What is a parable? This is a parable. But what is a parable? And we often have heard, I suppose, if we've been around Christian circles for a while, that it's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Not exactly sure what that means, but when I began to grapple with it, an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, that is a pretty limited definition. It's okay as far as it goes, but it's pretty inadequate. If we go to the Greek word, parabolo, you can hear the sound, parabola. It's the idea of two Greek words. Balo is to throw, and para is alongside or beside. You got parachute, paragraph, you know, parallel, those kinds of things, alongside or beside. So it's the idea of a story being thrown down alongside something, almost like a measuring stick. How does it measure our attitudes? Do they measure up to the parable? Our view of God and what he is doing, does that measure up with the parable, the measuring stick, the thing thrown down beside? Still, I'm not completely convinced I understand what a parable is, just on those two definitions. A parable tells us a story. It gives us a glimpse of life that we think we know. Right? It talks about ordinary, everyday, garden variety things in our lives. But when our guard is down, when we sort of think, yeah, we understand the story, when Jesus tells a parable, he's telling us about everyday things, and then all of a sudden, when our guard is down, whammo. We get a curve thrown at us that we don't quite understand what's going on. We're sort of knocked off balance by what he does with the parable, usually. Is a parable an illustration? Yeah, but it's more than that. Is a parable a way of judging us or understanding God? Yeah, but it's still more than that. A parable, as I said before, commonly just uses common characters and objects and situations. For example, a farmer sowing in a field to an agricultural community, a pretty common event. To the fishermen, we have a net going down into the sea and bringing up all manner of sea life. To a woman who's familiar with baking, we've got three measures of leaven put into a lump of dough. And it just goes on and on and on. Things that are just ordinary, common, everyday events and things in life. And yet, we have this twist. And with that twist, I don't know if you get right involved in the story and you're sucked right into what happens. And then all of a sudden, there's this twist that takes place. And if you don't catch yourself, you're confused. Like I was confused when I read this again. I'm not saying I understand this parable completely either, still. So you're confused. Sometimes you get angry at the apparent injustice of things. Maybe it makes you fearful because what's happening here is so far beyond the way I'm living that I don't, whatever. When I read a parable of common things and all of a sudden there's this twist, I'm disoriented. And in that disorientation, I'm being called to look at life and the way I live and my understanding of God and all these other things. I'm being called to look at these things with a fresh heart and fresh eyes. This isn't just humdrum, repetitive stuff that I already know. This is going to push us off balance and say, you thought you knew about this, but let me get you thinking about it again from a different angle so that you come away with a far fuller understanding of God, what he's doing, and of yourself. A parable does those kinds of things. It changes. I've got one comment here from one author that a parable's ultimate aim, this doesn't define what a parable is, but it tells you what a parable does. A parable has an ultimate aim to awaken insight, to stimulate the conscience, and to move us to action. Klein Snodgrass, an unfortunate name, but a very good book on parables. Klein Snodgrass writes this about the purpose of parables, and you'll find this written in your bulletin if you want to take it away with you. He writes, the parables compel us, for Christ's sake, literally, to do something. Parables do not seek the mild morality, but radical cross-bearing, God-imitating response worthy of the name conversion. If we are followers of Jesus, when we come across a parable, we're invited into the story to live kingdom values, not continue the humdrum life that we're so used to. So, as we read this parable, what's the twist? As we're drawn in to view things the way God views them and distance ourselves from the way we're typically understanding things. So let's go into the second phase here. What does this parable mean? No, that's the third. What does this parable say? And basically just let's observe a few things. This starts out with a formula. Well, actually, if you look in 19 verse 30 and then 20 verse 16, you've got a relatively similar statement. Many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. And then that's flipped so that the last will be first and the first will be last at the end. We'll come back to that. But as we enter into verse 20, we see this typical Matthew-like introduction of a parable. The kingdom of heaven is like. And there was about eight of those kinds of parables, say, in chapter 13. So we're familiar with that formula if we've read through Matthew. It's like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. A common Palestinian occupation. A vineyard. The vines are heavy with grapes. It's time to harvest. Harvesting grapes is time sensitive. Working in a quarry where you could wait whenever you want to get the rock out. Working in a vineyard is time sensitive. I think that's important. But we see here the landowner went out early in the morning to hire men to work in the vineyard. And he would have gone into the marketplace and he would have seen men there, day laborers. They would have worked for a day for the typical salary, which is a denarius. And you'll see what he did there in verse 2. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. And the work day would have started at sunrise, let's say for argument's sake, 6 a.m. in the morning. That's redundant. A.M. is in the morning. A 12-hour day would work till sunset, 6 p.m. in the afternoon. Okay. The evening. So for 12 hours, they got a denarius. Now, if a person worked 200 days, they would have got 200 denarii, and that was seen to be the poverty level. Anything at 200 denarii and below is poverty level. So you can see that this denarius is the it's just sort of the basic living salary that a person could have. If you don't work that day, if you don't get a denarius at the end of the day, you go hungry, and your family goes hungry, unless you saved up some money somewhere. Okay, so they just lived from hand to mouth. From each day, they would get enough to live for the next day. And he agreed with them to pay them this denarius for their day's work. Verse 3, about the third hour, it says, so somewhere close to 9 o'clock in the morning, 3 hours into the work day, this man went out again into the marketplace, and he saw others standing there, doing nothing. Now, there's no aspersions cast on a person doing nothing here. There was nothing. They weren't hired, so it wasn't as if they were lazy. It's just that they hadn't been given the opportunity to work. He told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." And note this: I will pay you whatever is right. And I think what would have been right is I would have figured, okay, I'm going to work now for 9 hours out of 12 hours. I could expect 3/4 of a denarius. That would have been proportionately fair, right? If I can put it that way. Don't particularly care for the word fair, but we went through that the other night, didn't we? Yeah. It's a wuss word. I was asked what a wuss word is. I couldn't even spell wuss, but anyway, we'll not go there either. So you can see what's happened. So that's the second group of men. The third group, he went out again about the sixth hour, 12 noon, and the ninth hour, 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and did the same thing. So now we've got four groups of workers. And then about the 11th hour, 5 o'clock, 1 hour left in the workday, he went out and he found still others standing around and he asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. "You also go and work in my vineyard." And then we see when the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones and hired and going to the first." In other words, the ones hired at 5 p.m. were the ones at the front of the line. The ones hired last were the first in line to get paid. Interesting observation in our care group is that the landowner could have avoided a big problem here if he started by paying the first ones who came first. They would take the denarius, put it in their pouch, and they would walk off and be gone and be no wiser that the fellows who came at 5 p.m. also got a denarius. They wouldn't have known enough to have an argument with him. But he creates the tension in this parable. There's a twist here. He purposely says, take the ones that were hired at 5 p.m. and pay them first. And very openly, he gives them a denarius, a full day's wage for 1 hour's work. Well, if I was a 12-hour worker at the end of the line, I was going, you know, one denarius for 1 hour, that means 12 denarii, 2 weeks' salary for 1 day's work. Sorry, am I? Okay. But you get the idea. My expectations would have arisen as I would have said, this is going to be a great day. And so the ones that come at 3 p.m., they also got a denarius. And he's saying, oh, my, just a minute now. That's not quite right. They should have got 3 denarii. But all the same, you know, if they get 1 denarii for a quarter day's work, I'm still going to end up with 4 denarii, eh? And then the ones at 12 who worked half a day, still 1 denarii. And I'm saying, that's only 2 denarii. All of a sudden, my 12 denarii has become 2 denarii. And the ones at 9, they only worked 3 hours less than me, and they're still getting 1 denarii. So that means I might get a denarii in a bit. And then comes time for me, and he plunks a denarii in my hand. And I said, what gives here? You gave those guys who worked only 1 hour the same that you're paying me. And I've borne all the work of the day, the heat of the sun. And you've given me only 1 lousy denarii. That's not fair. That's not fair. Well, I was excited. I'm upset. You get the point. That's the story. A common everyday event in Palestine. And he puts this big twist in it. And what do? My heart sides with the 12-hour worker. And I say in my own heart, when I look at the story, the landowner is not being fair to those men. What do you think? Do you side with the 12-hour owner? Do you think something wrong has gone on here? I mean, we have sayings, don't we? First come, first served. You snooze, you lose. Equal pay for equal work. That's the way we think in our worldly mindset. And what we have here is no, it's inverted. The first will be last. The last will be first. That's the twist. That's made me angry. It's made me confused anyway. And thrown me a little off balance. And it's calling me to rethink who God is and how God acts. And to rethink my heart. That's what this parable is calling us to look at. God's way of doing things and my expectations. There's more there. But at least that. Well, we see this little argument at the end. After this guy, had complained, the landowner answered one of them, friend. Now, if you look at the situations where Jesus refers to friend, you'll see that he's being kind but distant. He's not calling him brother. He's calling him friend as if you're in an argument and you say, dear, forget the context there. That's usually me that hears that, by the way. But he's saying, friend, he's still being polite, but he's being firm and distant. Friend, I am not being wrong to you. I am not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for me for a denarius? Yeah, but. No buts. Take your pay and go. You got what you agreed to be paid. That's exactly what he said to him in verse 2. They agreed to work for denarius, and that's what they got. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I'm generous? You've got a problem with me, not with the rightness of or the wrongness of the situation. Now keep in mind here too, I guess there's a sense in which if a man who had wanted work all day long and only got 1 hour's work at the end of it, if he got less than a denarius, he probably would not have had enough to feed himself and his family. So there's a sense in which the generosity to those who didn't work 12 hours really is a concession to the fact that they needed a denarius to eat. Keep that in mind as well. Um, Some of you will have this idea of evil eye, and the King James Bible, for example, and the New King James literally translate at the end of verse 15, are you of an evil eye? Do you have an evil eye? And the idea there of evil eye was envying somebody else's stuff. So that's why we have in more modern translations, not literally evil eye, but the translation and interpretation, if you will, are you envious because I am generous? And there's just two completely different attitudes. Envy is quite opposite from generosity. Keep that in mind as well. But, you know, as I read through this, as I know what it says, I'm still left with the sense that something doesn't sit right with me. What about you? It still doesn't sit right with me. If I was a 12-hour laborer, I still, this idea of only getting a denarius when that guy who worked an hour got that same amount for 1/12 the work, it would stick in my craw. Wouldn't it? With you? So what is Jesus getting at with this parable? And that's where we move into the third part of our time together here. What does it mean? Now, one author on parables indicates that this parable is one of the three most difficult parables in the whole New Testament, in that person's opinion. I tend to agree. I think it's a difficult parable to understand, but not impossible, at least to give it a stab, and that's what I want to do today. But keep in mind that we may not go away with full satisfaction on what's going on here. But if you have been pushed off balance, if you've been challenged to consider how you view God, how you view His kingdom, how you view working in His kingdom, if you've been pushed off balance a bit in those areas, to think about it a little more deeply, to think about it with fresh eyes, then we've accomplished something here today. Even if you don't go away fully satisfied with an understanding of this parable. If you go away still off balance, that's a good thing. So as I go through here and looking at so many of these commentaries, I came up with a bunch of ideas that people had that I'll leave the one that I side with till the end so you know which one to cheer for. But if we go through these here, and usually a lot of the medieval scholars heavily allegorize the parable. So they focus on the history. Some of them think about dispensations of history. For example, there were how many groups of workers? How many groups? Five, okay. 12, or the ones that went in the first hour, third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, 11th hour, five groups. And so they've divided history up into five groups, from Adam to Noah, from Noah to Abraham, from Abraham to Moses, from Moses to Christ, from Christ to the present. Nice, fancy, but it doesn't have anything to do with what this parable's about. It's completely divorced from context. Here's a better one, it's a worse one, actually. They think of five stages of life, those people who come to faith in Jesus Christ as children, who come as teenagers, adolescents, those who come as in the prime of life, which I consider 59 now. then we've got older people. That's like, you know, George, older people. Yeah. No. And then we've got deathbed experiences. So, but again, it has nothing to do with the context. It's severed this whole parable from its contextual moorings. A second way of looking at it is salvation, grace versus works. The difficulty I have with that right off the top is everybody worked for a denarius here. So what's that got to do with grace? It doesn't fit the context. Then you've got people, Jews versus Gentiles. Again, where are we going here? No, that's people, Jesus accepting sinners. Again, it's not in the context. I don't know what you're smoking when you come up with these kinds of things. It's just not there. And then the next one is, Jews versus Gentiles. Again, it's just not there. There's no division here in the context between Jews and Gentiles. And then you go to the social aspects. You get some of this from what they call liberation theologians. The abuse of peasants by the wealthy. But give me a break. The landowner was generous to everybody but the one he paid full wage to. So again, it's the abuse of peasants by landowners is just not reflected in the parable. And then where I'm going to go, sort of, is it's on discipleship. It's on attitudes. It's directed against envy, against greed, about boastings and any kind of reckoning among Jesus' disciples. So there we have, I guess, some evidence. I've looked at what various people say about these parables, and I come up with just a host of conflicting ideas. And what I want to do now is I want to just give you a few simple rules to understand parables that might be helpful. Here's some guidelines. First of all, there's the context. We think of, in the widest sense, the context of Matthew's gospel. We've dealt with this. What is Matthew's gospel about? And his purpose you'll find right at the end. The key is in the last four or five verses of Matthew. He says to his disciples, after he acknowledges who he is, all authority, Jesus says, has been given unto me in heaven and on earth. I mean, there's no authority beyond that. Go and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them everything I've taught you. And you know what? I'm with you unto the very end of the age. Matthew is about discipleship. So a bit of a clue here. When we read this portion, looking for something that's going to speak to us as disciples, followers of Jesus, is going to give us some direction, but only very simply, very broadly. Then we see that it's the context, more specifically, of chapter 20 of Matthew. And again, you cannot simply cut the rope that ties Matthew 20 to Matthew 19 and whatever comes after this parable. It's like cutting the ropes that hold a ship and just letting it drift. Do not cut the ropes of context. What comes before this parable is a discussion by Jesus after they've had this confrontation with the rich young man. And Peter asks, as a disciple, he asks, what do we get? And he talks to him about future reward. And then immediately he goes into the last, many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first, for the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner. It's about discipleship. It's about being involved in the labor of the kingdom of heaven. And then at the very end of the parable, we've got the same thing in verse 16. So the last will be first and the first will be last. Now, as Jesus was going to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, and he tells them about his impending crucifixion in Jerusalem. Future rewards, present service, and suffering is the context on either sides of this particular parable. Then we see we have a formula. The kingdom of heaven is like. And we could go back to chapter 13 and I'll just refresh your memories with two parables, very brief ones. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure. What's the focus here, folks? Treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. Then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought the field. Speaking to us. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that's hidden. And if you find it, get fully invested in it. Give everything you've got to get that treasure. We, as followers of Jesus, have to be fully invested in the treasure of the kingdom. The very next one, the very next verse, verse 45. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like what? A merchant. It's the flip side of the coin. I am to be fully invested in this hidden treasure. God is fully invested in this kingdom as well. He's a merchant looking for fine pearls, and when he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. I am to be fully invested in the kingdom. God, pictured here as a merchant, is fully invested in his kingdom. So when we see that phrase, the kingdom of heaven is like, It's going to tell us what the focus of the whole parable is about. And this one says in chapter 20, verse 1, the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner. It's not focusing on the vineyard. It's not focusing on the coin. It's not focusing on the laborers. It's focusing on the landowner. That's the focus. The first being last and the last being first is a theme, but the focus is the landowner. And if we lose sight of that, if our interpretation brings us to some other silly interpretations of what this parable apparently means, we've missed the point that Jesus is trying to make. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner. And what's he doing? He went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. Not in a quarry. Again, a quarry is where you get rocks. They can wait. They don't have to be cut out today. They can be, but you could do it any time and still get the same rock. But a vineyard, going out and harvesting a vineyard is very, very time sensitive. You can't do it early. Otherwise, you've got green, bitter grapes. If you do it too late, they're rotting. There is a time when we are to labor in the vineyard. And that's why he hires workers. But the focus is the landowner. Then we see, to whom is it written? I did push the button, but nothing happened. There it is, the audience. To whom is it spoken? And again, people just don't think about these things. You should. Who is being addressed here? Go back to the previous chapter, verse 23. Jesus said to his disciples, verse 25, when the disciples heard this, verse 26, Jesus looked at them and said, verse 27, Peter answers, and Jesus said to them in verse 28, he's addressing the disciples. And when we finish the parable, the very first verse, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, the audience here is not a mixed multitude of some sinners and some lost, of some people in the kingdom and others not. This is addressed to the followers of Jesus. Only it's addressed to you and me as disciples. And then we see the literary structure. And we can look at various things. We've seen this phrase at the beginning, many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. And we see it again at the end, only in reverse order. The last will be first, the first will be last. And that's called an inclusio. It's like a picture frame around a picture. It puts boundaries on this. So we know that the parable is bounded. It's about first things being last, or first ones, first people being last ones, and last ones being first ones. It's plural. We also see there's certain words here, but I don't want to get too detailed here. One of the key words is right and wrong. And we see in verse 4, I will pay you whatever is right. And in verse 13, friend, I am not doing you any wrong. And it's just a not right word. So that's where we're at. We've got a few guidelines here, and you could use that for reading other parables as well. So what do we glean from this parable? Well, it's about the landowner. We've seen that he's the focus. And it's about him being in his vineyard. And I want to ask the question, what is the landowner doing? And why is the landowner doing it? I think there are two questions we've got to ask if the landowner is the focus. What is he doing? He's hiring people to harvest his vineyard. Why is he doing it? Because he has to do it. No one else is going to do it. It's got to be done. And it's got to be done now. We see that the landowner is right. We saw that already in verses 2 and 13. Or was it 4 and 13? We see that he is good. We see that he's sovereign. He does what he wants with his resources. So, as I've been pushed off balance, and I'm thinking about what kind of landowner this is, he seems to be operating unfairly. I'm called by this parable, in my confusion and perhaps even my anger, to consider the landowner. He is harvesting his vineyard because it has to be harvested. He's not doing it so much for money as obligation as a responsible landowner. He's doing it because it has to be done. There's no sense here that he's being paid for this, although I would imagine if we wanted to push it, he would be. It's ultimately for his benefit. But he's a landowner. Who does it speak of to us of? Who is the landowner if we're going to interpret that? I think it's very easy to come to the conclusion this landowner is God. When we look at the use of vineyards elsewhere in parables, we see that, yeah, it can be Israel, but it's bigger than that. A vineyard is a place where God is at work. It's God's workplace. So here we have God in his workplace hiring others to harvest for him. What is God doing and why is he doing it? Is he doing it for reward or is he doing it out of love? Is this about rewards for me now as a hired person? I'm kind of thinking that there's a possibility there. Yeah, it's about future rewards, but it's also about what I'm getting now. I'm a day laborer. It's only one day at a time. Am I prepared, as a person who has been called into God's vineyard to harvest his crop, to work in his place, am I going to complain about my wages? You know, if I was in this for the money, I would not have given up a career in law. Strange as that might seem. Is it about how much we can get out of this? Or is it about having the same heart as the landowner's heart? I work hard in my ministry, but I see other ministries that seem almost effortless and so successful. Am I jealous at the 11th hour worker because I've worked through the heat of the day? Is my attitude competitive with my brothers and sisters in the vineyard? Am I trying to push to the front of the line so I can be first, so I can be well known, so I can be famous, so I can be wealthy and comfortable? Or am I content simply to go and work in the vineyard for this landowner, knowing that he will pay me what is right? He will give me everything that I need to continue to live from day to day to day. I'm wondering if that's what we're hearing here in this parable. Not fancy dispensationalism or whatever. Not Jew versus Gentile. But simply, you are being called, I am being called by our loving God into the vineyard in this time-sensitive labor of harvesting souls for Christ. Of living as representatives of Jesus in this world. Or if I can come back to our theme, of joining Jesus and his mission to this world. Are you still off balance? That's okay. What is important here? Is it the work or is it the wage? Am I a giver or a getter? Am I a rejoicer over others or a regulator of what they should or should not get? Am I a truster or a taker? My heart is being drawn from my worldly attitude of what I think is right and wrong into the King's view of what is right and what is wrong. My heart is being drawn by this parable, I would suggest, to begin to beat in harmony with the heart of God. Completely different way of looking at the world. Completely different way of looking at labor. Joining with Jesus in his mission to this world. Let's close in prayer. Father, as we look at this difficult and confusing story, this parable. We ask that you would continue to keep us off balance, so to speak, if it causes us to be looking at how we live and how you want us to live with fresh eyes. Father, in this confusion and disorientation, perhaps even anger and fear, we ask that you would be revealing your heart to us so that we might know how we should be living as we labor in your vineyard for your glory.